Today's guest, Amy Stewart, wants everyone who walks through a botanic garden or hikes a mountain ridge to see not just greenery, but the very elixir of life. Amy's latest book is The Drunken Botanist. She's found horticulture in a bottle to be an intoxicating topic, and you just might as well after giving her a listen. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Amy, thanks so much for joining us today on Tributaries.
Well, thank you.
Is there one story about the origins of fermentation or distilling that just really grabs you the most?
Well, one thing that I was very interested in, so here's something that I'd always kind of taken for granted, is that the yeast that is used to ferment grapes in order to make wine, I think I had always assumed that that yeast just naturally grows on the fruit, right? Like that it's just present on the skin, and that's what's used to then turn the sugars in grapes into wine. And what I found out is that originally the yeast that we most widely use today for making wine actually thrived on the bark of oak trees. It actually lived on the exudates, the little stuff given off by oak tree bark. And that somehow people, early humans, maybe they were gathering grapes and acorns in the same basket or something like that. But somehow those two things came together, thanks possibly to human activity, and it turned out to be this perfect match. And that's actually why wine is the way it is today.
Right. I wonder if it was because they started making barrels to hold their grape juice.
Well, this would have probably been pre-barrels. It's some people think that maybe the vines were actually growing up oak trees, because this would have been before trellises. This would have been,
definitely
before
yes.
anything. So, yeah, there's all kinds of ideas about why that is. But somehow that particular strain of yeast made its way into, fermentation equipment of the time, which would have been very primitive, and became a domesticated species. Yeast is actually the oldest living domesticated organism on the planet. Not chickens, not dogs and cats, but yeast.
Terence McKenna covered history via man's addictions with various mind-altering plants and spirits, sharing that mead may have been the offshoot of trying to preserve magic mushrooms in honey. There must have been something that spurred this creative venture into spirits.
Yeah, there would have been a lot of trial and error and a lot of experimentation. I talked when I was writing Drunken Botanist, or when I was doing the research, I talked to Patrick McGovern, who has made quite a name for himself as an archaeologist who specializes in the history of fermentation and distillation. And he actually analyzes the residue on pottery shards at archaeological digs to see what those vessels once held and to recreate the alcoholic beverages that they were drinking, which turn out to be really weird. Like one of them includes muscat grapes and also barley, and a strange combination of herbs and spices. So like it wasn't beer, and it wasn't wine. It was something else. And it was probably very cloudy and had a lot of stuff floating in it. like they would have straws that went into drinking vessels into the center because there would be some stuff that settled in the bottom and you didn't want to drink that. And there'd probably be like some bugs swimming around on the top and you didn't want to drink that. So you'd put your straw right in the middle and that's what you would drink.
Oh, that's perfect. What's the difference, or how do you differentiate between using fermentation and distilling? Are they basically the same process?
Well, fermentation always comes first. So fermentation just means that you take sugar and you feed it to yeast organisms. And yeast give off a couple of waste products. We all give off waste products, right? But we don't happen to do nearly as interesting a job of it as yeast do, because the waste that they excrete is ethyl alcohol and CO2, the bubbles, like in champagne or in beer. So that's all fermentation is just feeding sugar to yeast organisms and letting them do what they do, and they release all of this alcohol as a result. But the yeast can't live in their own waste for very long. So once the alcohol level gets to about maybe 14-15%, the yeast start to die off. So the most you can do is make beer or wine through that process. If you want to make a higher proof spirit, then you have to distill it. So then you take that fermented batch of stuff, liquid of some kind, and you basically boil it. And the ethyl alcohol has its own boiling point, just like any liquid has its own boiling point. And so you, you know, use a still to siphon off the ethyl alcohol as it lifts out at its particular boiling point. And that's what a high-proof spirit is. And people didn't know how to do that until about 800 A.D. So before then, no one on the planet had had a stiff drink.
Oh, dear.
and they might have needed one by then, if you think about, you know, everything they'd been through.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Is that the time then in that distilling process when you add the herbs and the various aromas to go into a spirit?
Well, you know, the idea of adding plants to an alcoholic beverage is also very early, and it's something that, you know, the Greeks and Romans and even civilizations before them would have done, possibly as a preservative and possibly to make it taste better. So, for instance, there were a lot of plants that were added to beer to try to make it last longer, and hops came along later, and hops turned out to be a great preservative. But before that, there were other plants that were used. And then there were a lot of plants that were used as medicine. Like the Greeks had this tradition of adding tree resin, like the resin of pine trees, to wine. And this is, you can still find this. If you go to Greece, you can still find wine called Restina, and it actually has resin in it. And it was thought to be maybe medicinal. There was sort of this idea at the time that, like, well, tree sap heals wounds on trees, so maybe if we drink it, it would heal wounds in our body too. You know, they had this very sort of stripped-down primitive idea of how medicine might work.
Well,
there were all kinds of, I mean, vermouth is really a very ancient drink. It's wine that has herbs and spices and fruit added to it, and the Greeks were doing that.
It's amazing, Amy, that you're mentioning the pine tree resin, because the last 2 weeks on Tributaries, I was speaking to a really quite brilliant naturalist as far as medicine and healing and health go. And there is quite a little network of people out there who take turpentine, the pure tree resin, of course, from the pine tree, as a medicine, because it's a brilliant blood cleanser. And so when you clean the blood and then your intestines all get cleaned from that, the healing that happens is amazing.
Well, that's interesting. You know, one of the things that I discovered as I was doing research for this book is that a lot of the sort of ancient plant remedies that we might scoff at today are being reinvestigated and reevaluated using 21st century science. So I haven't heard much about that in particular, but there are many other plants that are in the book that got their start as medicine and then became a popular cocktail ingredient and now are being looked at again under the idea of, you know, maybe 100,000 years of human experimentation isn't all wrong. maybe ancient people got a few things right.
Absolutely. Your book, The Drunken Botanist, shares your in-depth discoveries regarding so many botanicals, their history and the science and chemistry of, in your book, over 150 plants and flowers, trees, fruits, and fungi. And what do they all have in common? Is there a common denominator for these 150 that went into your book?
Well, I was really trying to choose the plants that are most likely to be in the bottles that you will find when you walk into a good liquor store. So, for instance, a bottle of chartreuse has, according to the people who make chartreuse, has, you know, 130 different herbs and spices and fruits in it. So that's a secret recipe. It's hard to know exactly what's in there, but there are all kinds of plants that have been used throughout history, specifically in alcohol. And I wanted to touch on the most common ones and also some of the really rare and strange ones around the world, just to give people a sense that almost any plant that isn't poisonous has been soaked in alcohol for one reason or another, and a few of them that are poisonous as well, by the way. So, yeah, my criteria was really, you know, if you go into a bar and order a Negroni, all the plants that are in that Negroni are going to be in the book.
You start with agave, due to starting with the letter A, of course.
Right, right.
And the origins of this plant conjure up in my mind it being a companion to some magic mushrooms or peyote or something. You write about the pulque goddess breastfeeding her drunken rabbit children. And I bet it was really fun and maybe interesting in your research for this project to really decipher some kind of reality almost in the history of all of these things, because I'm sure whoever was writing about something intensely might have been imbibing some of what they were writing about. And so was it difficult to, or did you care about how much truth from the history that you were writing about? And
oh, yeah. Well, this is a very big deal for me. You know, with Drunken Botanist, and this is also true, especially I wrote two books about poisons in the natural world, Wicked Plants and Wicked Bugs. And all three of these books look like little kind of lightweight, gifty books because they're illustrated and they're very pretty, but they have a crazy amount of research behind them. And it's very important to me to make sure that what I'm talking about is accurate. So, for instance, if I read in a book about the history of beer that Socrates said something, I'm not going to re-quote it just because I found it in an authoritative-looking book on the history of beer. I actually go back to Socrates' writings. I make sure I find a good translation that is respected in the academic community, and I rely on that. And very often I find mistakes when I do things like that. So I managed to debunk a lot of myths. Some of them are myths that nobody cares about but me and about 12 other people who are super into this kind of history. But I go back to primary sources to an amazing extent. I hire translators. So, for instance, if there's a 300-year-old German text that I think might be the earliest mention of something, I will hire somebody to give me an accurate translation of that if it hasn't been translated. There are definitely legends and lore that are in the book only because they're sort of, I think, culturally relevant or interesting, but I'm always clear to call them out as legends or unconfirmed rumors, like this is what has always been believed or this is a popular belief about this. There's an astonishing amount of legend and myth and just plain misunderstanding in the plant world, and I didn't think any field of study could be more riddled with just inaccuracies and kind of nonsense than the plant world. But then I started studying the history of booze. I was like, oh, yeah, wait, this is actually worse.
Did researching the book open your eyes as to your thoughts about mythology?
Well, you know, it's actually been a pretty small part of this book, to tell you the truth. Mostly what I was trying to do was to stay with the actual plants and what they do. Like, why is this particular plant added to wine? What about the plant's chemistry? What about the flavor molecules? What makes it something that you would soak in a bottle of wine? So I tried to really make it all about the plants because there are a lot of other books out there that get into legends and lore and mythology as it pertains to, you know, our drinking culture. And I wasn't trying to really reinvent the wheel there. What I was trying to do was say what has never been said about our drinking traditions, which is to really trace the plants and to do a plant-focused perspective on it. So for the most part, the myths were kind of little, they're interesting, and people who are interested in that will find their way to the other sources that have done that in a much more in-depth treatment than I was really able to do.
Yes, well, you definitely do reach into the science and the chemistry of it all, and almost right off the bat, you write that nightshades are one weird family of plants, and tell us about them. What makes them so weird? Are they distillable? And
well, within the nightshade family, there are plenty of poisons. You know, there's Atropa belladonna, which is a very toxic plant, deadly nightshade, very serious poison. But there are also plants that that we eat. So there's tomatoes, and there's eggplant, and there's tobacco. So so it is a really interesting family of plants in that they're, you know, something like tobacco. Think about the consequences to that plant around the world, right? I mean, not only the health consequences, but the way that it's been used throughout history and the way that it drove the slave trade. Like, it's sort of astonishing that one single plant could have so much power in human history. And then at the same time, there are these toxic plants that you'd better just stay away from. So it's just a fascinating family of plants because it is very psychotropically active and deadly, but we can't seem to stay away from them.
What are some of the technological and chemical trends coming into the picture, into this plant world that originally was creating the great drinks, and now I'm sure there is just a huge new part of this going on?
Well, you know, there's a lot happening right now. You know, for one thing, a lot of plants are being, like I said earlier, are being explored for their pharmaceutical benefits. A great example of that that's in The Drunken Botanist is gentian root, which is, you know, a plant that has been used going back to ancient Chinese medicine and ancient South African medicine and the Greeks and Romans as well, and Egyptians, was used to treat stomach ailments and other problems, and then became a very standard thing to add to alcohol. It's in all kinds of liqueurs and bitters and aperitifs. And now, in the 21st century, there are botanists going all over the world and evaluating different species of gentian for their pharmaceutical potential by doing, you know, very sophisticated technological analysis that wasn't possible until, you know, really just a few years ago. So there's really just an explosion, I think, of interest in what these plants are and what they can do, which is pretty exciting.
Definitely. Are they using chemicals from the lab in liqueurs now more than natural ingredients, for instance?
Well, not at all. I mean, this is the point that I'm really trying to make for people, is that a bottle of gin is nothing but plants. I mean, really, you walk into a distillery and there will be a big bin of juniper berries, and there will be a big bin of citrus peel, and one of coriander, and if they're making their own alcohol on site, then there will also be some barley or some corn or, you know, whatever the alcohol itself is made from. I mean, they are starting with the raw plant ingredients. If they're going to use anything artificial, it has to be on the label. It has to at least say with artificial ingredients. They don't necessarily have to say what. But no bottle of booze worth anything has artificial ingredients in it. It's all just purely distilled from plants. And I think that's sort of hard for people to get their minds around, because we expect everything to be artificial and we expect it to be all chemicals. But it's truly not, again, except for the cheapest stuff. If you buy a bottle of cocktail syrup that's bright blue, I promise you that did not come from a plant.
Yes.
But the good stuff really is. And the trend, of course, with craft distillers and more European distillers bringing back their old recipes as they see the interest in it, the trend is towards, you know, even fresher and more natural ingredients.
Sure. Organics are coming quite into the industry as well.
Yeah, organic and GMO-free are big deals right now for distillers.
Thank goodness.
In the U.S. So yeah, all of that. But even, you know, even something that you might think of as very ordinary, like a bottle of Tanqueray gin, there's no chemicals in that. There's no, you know, there's nothing artificial in that.
Well, we may start a new trend here. If there's nothing artificial in that and there's artificial in everything else, we may just all have to change our diets.
Well, here's the thing to remember, is that just because something is 100% all natural does not mean it's good for you. I mean, I'm always telling people, let's not forget that alcohol is a poison. Let's not kid ourselves here.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, the plant world makes all kinds of 100% all natural ingredients that you don't want anything to do with, such as strychnine and cyanide and ricin. So So, you know, when you feed sugar to yeast, all kinds of things get created during that process, and most of them aren't very good for your liver. So we have to remember that.
Yes, definitely. I was curious to find out about whiskey in the last couple of years before I even saw your book, and all of a sudden it seemed like whiskey was a generic term. Because I found people were making whiskey out of all kinds of basic ingredients.
That's right. Whiskey is a generic term for an alcohol that is distilled up to kind of really a low point, meaning distilled up to about 60% alcohol or so, and then watered back down to maybe 40-45% to be put in the bottle. But all whiskey means is that you have fermented something, usually some grains, and then you have distilled it up to a certain point, and then maybe you've aged it in oak, maybe you haven't. The only difference between whiskey and vodka is that vodka gets distilled up to a much higher level of purity so that it's maybe, you know, 80 or 90% alcohol, and then they add water to get it back down to 40 or so percent to put it in the bottle. But the only difference between those two is just the technique used to extract the alcohol.
And it was also interesting for me to read about adding water to your drinks. It mm-hmm. seems most everyone just feels like, oh, well, why do that? You're just watering down your drink. But that's not the case, is it?
That's right. Yeah, this is something I really preach to audiences when I go around and talk, because usually when I give a talk, we're doing some kind of tasting as well. And I'm always having to explain to people that you want a little ice or a little water when you're drinking a spirit. And the reason is that when you add water to alcohol, all those oily flavor molecules that are from the plants themselves become very unstable in the presence of water, and so they break out of suspension and clump together. So if you imagine a bowl of soup that's got maybe some olive oil or some butter in it, and you can see them, you can see these big globs of oil floating on the top of your soup, that's what happens. And that's a good thing, because it means that you have these larger clumps of flavor molecules, and you can actually taste those flavors better. So adding a little splash of water or an ice cube to any spirit will not dilute the flavor. It'll make the flavor stronger and more available to the flavor receptors in your mouth. All professional tasters, like people who are spirit critics and taste professionally, always add a little water.
Now, is that something for wines as well?
No, not necessarily. You don't really have the same effect with wine. This is really something for higher proof spirits, because wine and beer are already fairly dilute. You know, the flavor
yes.
is already fairly dilute in those. And beer especially, you know, beer is kind of mostly water. I mean, you're taking grains and you're soaking them in water and feeding them to yeast organisms. So there's already plenty of water present there.
Yeah. Well, you offer tips for a cocktail garden. What is the first must-do?
Well, so my idea about growing your own cocktail ingredients is to grow the garnishes and mixers and muddlers that maybe aren't so easy to get at the grocery store, but that are actually things you like to drink. So one obvious choice is mint, right? I mean, there's no excuse for going to the grocery store to buy mint. But there are particular kinds of mint that are better in drinks. So, for instance, there is a Cuban mint called Mojito Mint that is actually the variety of mint that they use in Havana to make mojitos. And it is for sale here in the United States and in Canada. You can get it. So if you're a mojito fan, you should totally have a pot of Mojito Mint going somewhere around your house all the time. So I have a whole list of things like that that are sort of must-have for making cocktails.
Right. And what is your favorite plant in your garden?
Well, right now I'm growing black currants, which are so cool to grow. Black currant is the fruit that's used to make cassis, the wonderful French syrupy
yes.
fruity liqueur that you add to white wine to make a cure, or a cure royale if you add it to champagne. And I love French cassis. It had never occurred to me to grow black currants. But I found out that black currants were banned in the United States for most of the 20th century because they're a vector for white pine blister rust, which is a, you know, a disease that that the timber industry definitely wants to keep out of timber forests. But it turned out the ban was really unnecessary. It's pretty easy to prevent the disease from spreading. Black currants are not as big a threat as they were thought to be, and there are disease-resistant cultivars anyway. So the ban has been lifted, but most Americans are not used to growing black currants and have never seen them. So it's kind of an unusual plant to grow, but it does very well in the Pacific Northwest where I live. And so I have several of those going now. Maybe one of these days I'll get enough fruit to make my own cassis.
Now, I can't claim to know every bar in Boulder where I live, but it would seem that one of them at least would have a greenhouse next to the bar, and I haven't seen this yet.
Yeah, it's something that is definitely happening in bars all over the country. I actually go around and give talks about bars that are growing their own in one way or another. The hard thing for a bar is reliably having enough of whatever plant it is to serve people night in and night out.
Yes.
So sometimes these are maybe little rooftop bars, gardens, or little patio gardens that are mostly for show, but they can harvest enough here and there so that the plants are sprinkled throughout their drinks. And then some bars are very, very serious about it and actually maybe even partner with a farm and have some pretty significant land devoted to growing the ingredients for their cocktails. There's a restaurant here in California with a really extraordinary bar program, and everything the restaurant serves and every drink the bar serves is sourced from one farm. So if the farm isn't growing it, they don't say, you know, if the farm doesn't have any lemon trees producing fruit, there's no lemons in the drinks. They're very dedicated to this idea.
The Drunken Botanist is a follow-up to previous books, including New York Times bestselling Wicked Bugs and Wicked Plants, and all three have spawned exhibits and workshops, as you've just spoken about with The Drunken Botanist. Are you amazed that your passions are being embraced so wonderfully far and wide?
Well, you know, I think what people in the plant world are responding to is the fact that it's really just storytelling. What's interesting to me is not, you know, how tall does this plant get and does it grow in sun or shade, but how does it connect to our human history? So, for instance, with Wicked Plants, looking at poisonous plants, it's really fascinating to see all the different ways that plants have been used to wage war and to commit murder. There's a lot of drama and a lot of intrigue. So for a botanical garden to put on an exhibit, like there's this traveling exhibit that's going around the country now for years to come about wicked plants, and it gets people in the door and it gets them talking about plants in a completely new way. It's not so much, oh, let's go to the botanical garden and look at the pretty flowers in bloom, but it's got science and history and chemistry and so much going on that it engages people with the plant world in a way that they don't usually. And alcohol is the same way. You know, I go do an event at a botanical garden, like I was just at Denver Botanical Garden a month ago, and, you know, people turn up and they want to see the plants growing in the conservatory and they get to have a drink. Like, it's kind of a winner. I mean, who doesn't want to do that, you know?
Right. Amy Stewart, definitely a niche master. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.